Hi, Patrick here. Yeah, I'm back. Quite soon after the last pod, eh? So many languages, so little time. Today, there's a move in France to begin English language learning at age 3, to which one French linguist says, great, except why English?
Speaking English is not quite innocent, is not an unguilty act. Speaking English is speaking the language of very wealthy, industrialized countries. Any person who has a minimum of sense of justice cannot accept that.
Okay. Well, if not English, how about Irish? Ahead of an election, the Irish people are debating the merits of mandatory Irish learning in schools. Also, free speech in Tunisia. Suddenly they've got it. What do they do with it?
As a free man, I take pride in the word Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
I'm here with Patrick, and it's time to talk words. New words, old words, censoring everything.
The World in Words podcast and the World Radio program, The Big Show, they're both co-productions of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH radio station here in Boston. Online, The Big Show is at theworld.org. Online, this podcast is at theworld.org/language. That's where I post show notes for every podcast, except for this week, because I got a bit of a time crunch. But that's another story. You can also find my blog posts at patrickcox.wordpress.com. The pod is on Facebook, has a Facebook page. You can follow me on Twitter. I post a lot of language stories there. My handle is Patrick Cox, P-A-T-R-I-C-O-X. Today, we all know the research. The younger you learn a language, the better you'll be at speaking it. However, it's one thing to know this, quite another to actually make it happen. In France, yes, France, there are moves afoot to make it happen with English. Not that everyone agrees that English is the language that these kids should learn. Then it's on to the Irish language. Somehow, with all that Ireland is going through economically, the language has become an issue in upcoming elections. And then finally, a couple of things on speech in post-revolutionary Arab countries. What do you say or write or sing when you no longer need to worry about censorship? Okay, here's the perfect way to get under a Frenchman's skin. Suggest that everyone in France should learn English. Step up to the plate, Luc Châtel. He is France's education minister, and he wants children to study English starting at the age of 3. A magnificent plan, at least as far as a lot of language educators are concerned. But it doesn't end there, of course. Language, as we all know, can be a battleground. And in France, making a proposal like that about English really is a call to arms. Here's Anita Ilash.
Are you ready to sing, girls? All right. One little finger.
6 3-year-olds are taking their Wednesday morning English class at the Babylang Language School in Paris. They're too young to learn things like grammar or spelling, but singing songs and playing, they're getting a feel for the sound of English. After 15 classes, they've learned simple things like colors and the parts of their body.
On your chin! Chin, very good job.
Their teacher, linguist and Babylang founder Caroline Benoit-Lavy, says it's easier for young children to learn a second language, and studies suggest they'll benefit for the rest of their lives.
Kids who learn a foreign language early on in life have a better ability to read and write. They have a vocabulary that's richer compared to monolingual kids. You're learning another language helps you get better at your first language. It enhances your mother tongue as well.
But Babylang is a private school. For most children in France, second language instruction doesn't start until age 7. And most French people never master any language but their mother tongue. Education Minister Luc Châtel told French public television that's a problem he wants to fix.
Si vous voulez, aujourd'hui en France, ne pas maîtriser l'anglais, c'est un handicap.
He said the fact the French haven't mastered English is a major handicap, and he plans to reinvent how English is taught here. Châtel said that would mean starting English classes in nursery school using the internet and podcasts. Governments over the years have made other attempts to persuade the French to learn English, but none has provoked quite as much anger as Châtel's recent announcement has.
It's totally pointless, if not ridiculous.
That's linguist Claude Hagege, one of the loudest critics of Châtel's plan. He's won various medals in France for his work to promote and maintain a diversity of languages. He says everyone should learn several if they can. But he says language is power, and focusing only on English gives too much power to countries like the United States.
Speaking English is not quite innocent, is not an unguilty act. Speaking English is speaking the language of very wealthy, industrialized countries. And this, I think, any person who has a minimum of sense of justice cannot accept that. Because this means domination of the countries whose mother tongue this language is.
The parents who bring their children to Babylang say language diversity and international power struggles are the least of their concerns.
Je pense pas que le français soit menacé. Je trouve que le français c'est vraiment une très belle langue.
This woman says French is a beautiful, melodious language, but the fact is 80% of people in the world speak English, so it's absolutely essential to speak it as well as another language. That's a huge exaggeration. Still, she says she hopes that by coming here, she's giving her daughter a head start in a world where, like it or not, people who speak English often get the best opportunities. For The World, I'm Anita Ilash in Paris.
Oh, McDonald had a farm, E-I-E-I.
Hey, I sang that song in the last pod. Well, for more on English learning in France, check out my interview with Laurel Zuckerman. She's author of a book called Sorbonne Confidential. It was in, I think it was 55 and 56. Anyway, she has spent a lot of time looking at this very subject. Okay, Irish voters. They're about to go to the polls. The economy is the big issue. Of course, the country is near bankrupt. It's pretty desperate there. The next government will have little choice but to impose severe austerity measures, which makes it all the more unlikely that the Irish language has surfaced as an issue in the campaign. Here to tell us about it is Irish Times writer, going to have to practice this one a couple of times, Déglan de Breydoun. Déglan de Breydoun. Déglan de Breydoun. Practice makes perfect. And he told The Big Show's Lisa Mullins that Irish learning has been a cornerstone of Irish national identity ever since Ireland became a sovereign state with the introduction of a new constitution in 1937.
Well, Irish is the first official language of the country. It's in the constitution as the first official language. The state was originally founded. One of the reasons it was founded was to revive the Irish language, and a great effort was put into teaching Irish and trying to revive it through the school system in particular.
And how about you yourself? Did you have to learn Irish when you were growing up?
Well, it's a mandatory subject of study. When you do the equivalent of your high school diploma, you don't have to take the examination in it, but you have to study it. And that's the subject of controversy because the main opposition party, which is called Fine Gael, has suggested that it should no longer be mandatory and that you could it should be an optional subject. And this has caused uproar because in order to improve their Irish, a lot of Irish students, secondary high school students, go to the Irish-speaking districts in the summertime to improve their Irish by living in the houses with people whose first language is Irish and spending time in a district which is essentially Irish-speaking as a first language.
So the proposal to do away with the mandatory tenet that everyone, every student in order to graduate, learns the Irish language, that's drawn a lot of criticism, and a lot of young people, students, are the ones who are criticizing it. Why do you think it's particularly incendiary for them?
Not just young people. I think the people in the Irish-speaking districts, these districts are not prosperous. The land is poor, the soil is stony, and they're not overburdened with cash, I can tell you. They make money out of these students who come in the summer. I've been on these courses myself in my youth. It was a great experience. And the local people, they make money out of this, and it's an important supplementary source of income. And they're very worried that this will disappear if the language isn't a compulsory subject in school.
I wonder for people who are not in the Irish-speaking districts, if they can appreciate kind of the emotional impact of this. Does it kind of divide the country, those who care and those who don't care?
It's not a lightning rod issue like that. It's a mid-level issue. There's nobody out in the equivalent of Tahrir Square here protesting about it. And it's not an issue that concerns people as much as the state of the economy by any means.
Yeah, for sure. Although this does enter into the state of the economy for those in the certain districts.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah. If you're in an Irish class, what's it like?
Well, I always remember my first day in an Irish class in school. We sat down and we had pictures of hens and chickens, and we learned the words for those creatures. And then we learned how to have, you know, how to say hello and have ordinary conversation. And we took it from there. And then, as I say, when we got older, in our mid-teens, we would go off to these remote parts of the country on the West Coast where Irish is the first language. We would live in the houses of people whose first language was Irish, and they would speak Irish to us.
So it's like being an exchange student in your own country.
It was a bit like, I suppose, being taught English in Boston and then being sent to Tennessee, you know.
And can you give us an example with the Irish?
I suppose something like, Tome Kainch Latinov, Erin Vaughan. That would be the Munster pronunciation. And the Donegal would be, Tome Lurch Latinov.
I think you just turned into a different person then.
Yes, and, indeed.
And what's the English?
I'm talking to you on the telephone.
Oh, yes, indeed. Well, I'm glad you still recall it.
Yes.
Déaglann de Bray Dún, and the Big Show's Lisa Marlins. And there's more on Irish learning in a previous pod. In fact, a conversation I had with my dad, who's Irish. That's in the World in Words number... Let me look it up. Number 84. Okay, now, what happens to free speech and a free news media after a revolution, after decades of suppression and government control? In Tunisia, it's only been a month since people have been allowed to say what they feel and write what they feel. But when you get all of these new freedoms, it takes a while to get used to them. Here's reporter Sabri Benashour of station WAMU.
Along Tunis' main boulevard, stores are open and people drink coffee at sidewalk cafes. Just a few weeks ago, this same street was a war zone. Tear gas, stones, and bullets whirring through the air. And while all that was happening, there wasn't so much as a glimmer of it on Tunisian television.
The whole country was burning. People were revolting. And you know what they were showing on TV? It's a program about obesity. For God's sake, what obesity?
That's Nora Houidi, a 20-year-old student in Tunis. Like many Tunisians, she had little use for the old Tunisian media. Hmida Ben Romdan is the new director of La Presse, one of Tunisia's major newspapers. He says before, media chiefs owed their jobs to the dictator, Ben Ali.
When you have the boss who is faithful to the dictator, of course the journalists cannot do anything. Because if you write a piece and this piece seems unpleasant to the boss, of course you can't publish it. And this situation provoked a kind of self-censorship for the journalists.
It was this reality that led Ben Romdan to write an editorial entitled Mea Culpa on the front page of La Presse a couple weeks after Ben Ali departed. Ben Romdan apologized to readers for providing, quote, everything but the news, and promised a press that would be accurate, inclusive, and diverse. Now, he says, journalists at the paper are chomping at the bit to make that happen.
People find themselves free, and they behaved as if they were always free. So there is no any kind of self-censorship now, and people write very, very freely.
Things are different now. News reports actually describe what's going on. Satire, targeting public officials, absolutely unheard of under Ben Ali, flourishes on a popular radio station, Mosaic FM. Web pages are ostensibly no longer blocked, apart from pornography and terrorism-related sites. But there are still traces of the old ways. Some complain about deleted Facebook pages and blocked videos of police brutality against protesters. And beyond lingering censorship, Self-censorship is a hard habit to break. Take this example on a national TV talk show a few weeks after the regime fell. This guest challenges the host after he says someone backstage told him not to talk about politics.
This is happening in national TV. You're scared about your jobs, like others who did and who sold out. We got used to it. We have to get used to saying no. You should also expose yourselves to losing your jobs, like some of us who exposed our chest to bullets.
People like Riad Bin Fadl. 10 years ago, he was shot twice in the chest after he wrote a commentary in Le Monde calling for Ben Ali to step down. Now he runs a communications firm in Tunis. He agrees that some outlets are having difficulty making the transition to a free press, but others are going too far in another direction.
Malheureusement, la liberté de presse qui a été...
Unfortunately, freedom of the press has also sometimes led to excesses. Some journalists have a tendency to say everything. Because there was such a thirst for liberty, this thirst resulted in some unprofessional behavior.
He points to some journalists who repeated stories from Facebook that turned out not to be true. He says they need to get back to the basics of professional journalism. And he says Tunisia's journalists are trying to do that. A National Council on Communications is being set up to give guidance and training, though most are learning by trial and error.
Ces dérives, ces excès,
these excesses will be quickly corrected. It's better to have excesses with freedom of the press than to have responsibility with no freedom. The ideal is to have freedom and respect for the fundamental principles of the profession.
As one young man at a cafe put it, Tunisia is in the middle of tracing its own destiny. Like a prisoner freed abruptly after years of captivity, it'll take a little time to learn to be free. For The World, I'm Sabri Benachour, Tunis.
Singer Natasha Atlas closely watched the events in Tunisia from her home in Britain. She watched the protests in Egypt even more closely. She has Egyptian roots. She describes herself as Anglo-Middle Eastern. She's been thinking a lot about Egypt and free speech recently, and singing about it too. Here's The Big Show's Marco Werman.
Natasha Atlas has never been overtly political. She knows there are injustices in the world, and her songs at times have alluded to that. Then last year she released an album with a few songs that had pointed critiques, ones that were more political and urgent. One of those songs, Bet Kelam, begins with a sample of President Obama's now famous speech at Cairo University in 2009.
We meet at a time of great tension.
The song Bet Kelam is a political song which is really quite subversive.
Natasha Atlas says Bet Kelam explores the way political leaders embrace truth and lies. When the protests began in Cairo last month, she says, she and her producer, Sami Bishai, also Anglo-Egyptian, were glued to their television screens. And like many Egyptians abroad, they wanted to do something. They wanted to be there.
We couldn't go to Egypt. I was actually supposed to be going to Egypt and I couldn't go. So then we decided to do this video and free download in order to support the Egyptian people and just to kind of encourage them to stay with it, to stay standing against the oppression and against Mubarak. And I think that was basically all we could really do from where we were.
So Natasha Atlas and Sami Bishai reworked the lyrics and arrangements of two songs from her previous CD, including Bet Kelam. The sample of Obama they replaced with a new sample of Hosni Mubarak's menacing declaration that a fine line lies between freedom and chaos.
إن خيط الرفيع يفصل بين الحرية والفوضى.
Atlas and Bishai also drew on some of the most striking images from the protests for the video they produced for this new song called Egypt, Rise to Freedom. Natasha Atlas's lyrics remain very similar to those in Bet Kelam. Let us stand together and awaken. Permit us to know freedom. Let us know a land where words are the purveyors of truth. It was hard, says Atlas and Bishai, to be in London trying to support the protesters and their goals in Egypt. Bishai himself has dealt with that distance for 10 years. That's when he left Egypt.
There were very limited opportunities for a musician in Egypt. And a lot of that did have to do with the regime and the control of the regime and the fact that obviously art likes to express itself in different ways that don't always agree with the politics of the institution. As a result, sort of artistic thought was very restricted, and I was kind of one of the lucky ones in a way, because I'm of English and Egyptian origin, which made it possible for me to actually leave Egypt and chase my dreams of being a musician in England.
The video and free download of Egypt, Rise to Freedom are the products of two concerned Anglo-Egyptians. But it's not just something Atlas and Bishai did to support the demonstrators in Tahrir Square. Especially since Mubarak's resignation last Friday, Natasha Atlas now believes mass protests that can bring about change are possible anywhere.
I also would love to see this happening worldwide, because I think in some sense corruption is not just in Egypt or the Middle East. It's everywhere, but in the West it's just more hidden. So I hope that this inspires people to realize that change is in their hands. You know, through unity all things are possible.
For The World, I'm Marco Werman.
And if you were wondering what the music was at the top and bottom of the last pod I did, well, that was also Natasha Atlas. And that's it this week. I say this week, it's the second pod in 3 days. And why, I don't hear you asking me. Because, well, I'll be out of commission next week, on a ski slope, committing dangerous acts, doubtless humiliating ones too. See you at the après-ski, or maybe just après.
There's more work to be done.
We are not afraid.
Kill.
They're shooting indiscriminately.
He was assassinated by soldiers opposing plans to sign a peace.
Tear gas canisters
being fired.
Egyptians standing toe-to-toe with their government, a chorus of voices demanding change.
And the world is listening.